Biggest hit they ever had. We'll get to it. We had a great holiday, you guys. I brought your shirt, Frank. I've got it here. You can have it later. We had great fun shopping for a shirt for Frank. That's why we went, pretty much. There's this thing about vacation. I mean, when I go on vacation, I kind of, you know, trying to think a little bit, not just do it. And it kind of has this linkage to the idea of recreation in our culture, of renewal. And I find it curious how deep-seated our culture's assumptions are about the relationship between recreation and work, and how they're kind of dominated by one perspective. And generally speaking, that idea is that to be renewed, what we really need to do is we need to get away from our work in a way that kind of walls it off from everything else. And I mean, my work makes demands, like any work, and so there's a part of me that understands that. But for a lot of people that I meet, the whole paradigm seems to be predominantly negative, sort of this, I hate my work, I love not working, so a vacation is a chance to live the life that I love. It's kind of akin to the old rock song, everybody's working for the weekend. You know, like, it's kind of got that vibe about it. We loved our time away, but we didn't have that kind of an experience. And that's partly, I think, because what I find what we do here so intriguing. Like, I love what we get to do here, like what you were talking about, Jason. I mean, I think it's incredible. And so that's not something that I feel like I need to try to get away from so I can fill up my energy tank, because I have to come back to something that in the end is just depleting, you know? And so I'm grateful for that. I mean, I get tired, I want and need to rest, but that feels more like part of the rhythm of life. It's not some kind of all or nothing alternate universe where idleness is synonymous with paradise, you know? It kind of doesn't work like that. And I think another reason why our time away felt so good to me is because I knew that what was going to happen here in that month was going to be genuine exploration of belief. And that's what we're here to do. That's what this community exists to do, to explore what we believe in. So having some sense of settledness and comfort might be a strong or strange word there, I don't know, but that's kind of how it felt, like I was at ease about all that. And as a person who feels a sense of responsibility to the community, that was lovely and made it possible to just go away and explore on my own, and knowing that I would come back. And so I wanted to say thank you this evening for both a sense of permission and a really gracious facilitation of our time away as a family. I don't know how many of you have had a chance to live close to the organizational part of religious life, but if you ever have had, then you know that that's not necessarily a given. It may be, but it may not be, and I don't take it for granted, so thank you. And so I come home with this sense that of the best sort of obligation. Anyone who's ever traveled, I think, knows that a good part of what makes it delightful is that you get to bring back stories and you get to kind of try to let other people in on the adventure you had by, you know, sharing the gift that you've been given. It's easy to assume, I think, in our time that blazing off to some other part of the world is just a norm or even a right, you know, but it isn't. It's a privilege, and in a global sense, it's a privilege of a relatively small percentage of relatively wealthy people. And so grateful for that, too. So what I'm going to try to do out of that is just bring back stories, and I want to try to bring them back with a combination of enthusiasm and gentleness, because I realize bringing back stories can be alienating, too. So it's kind of a little bit of a balancing act, but it feels to me like a sense that that's part of what goes with the privilege of travel, that I have this opportunity and responsibility to share some of what we got to see and encounter. So I'll try to do that. And tonight we'll do that maybe in a little bit of a unique, more occupying way. Otherwise, I think it'll just sort of bleed in here and there as the stories fit whatever else is going on. If you've ever traveled in Europe, or even you sort of seriously looked at a map and thought about it, you know that it's possible in Europe to fit a lot of countries into not very much time. They're not very big, they're close together. Kind of get in your car and drive through six of them in a day, you know it. And we decided to spend our entire month away in Italy. And as Cale pointed out, with not very much folding, you could fit all of Italy into Manitoba. And so in terms of land mass, you know, we live with all this land, and these countries in Europe don't occupy that much land. But we did that partly because we've discovered as a family that the way we travel, if we spend a little more time in places and we just kind of dig in a little more, we get past the seeing the sights part of travel, and we actually start to encounter people and have experiences. And the stories we tend to come back, we listen to which stories the kids choose to tell, and they'll reference, you know, something they saw at the Uffizi Gallery in Florence. I mean, they've studied that, and they appreciated the experience and all that, but when they start storytelling, it's not about that. It's about the guy playing his accordion in some hill town in Italy while he was buying his groceries. I mean, it's like about these strange things that just happen that you could never plan, you know. And so that we just sort of found that that way of travel, that kind of a rhythm, gets us further in there. And so in the interest of that sort of experience, we spent the last week of our time in Venice. And I don't tend to be infatuated with cities. I don't even live in the one that's my home, you know. Like, so really, I'm not, cities and I are not like just instant buddies, but I was really taken with Venice. I would go back to Venice in a minute. And like other kinds of infatuation, which is sort of what it felt like, this one led to a little bit more exploration. And like other kinds of infatuation, the first things that struck me came in sensorily. You know, I liked what I saw, I liked what I smelled, I liked what I felt, and I wanted to know more. And when I started to dig a little bit deeper, what I discovered was that Venice and I have a lot in common, at least metaphorically speaking. And I'm going to suggest this evening that not just Venice and I, but Venice and us, that both us at the table and us in the Western world generally, and in some ways that are unique, us spiritually in the West, have some real commonality with the story of Venice that should be illustrative and instructive. And I sort of want to explore that a little bit. So Venice is, in fact, as the song says, sinking. Of course, it's built entirely, almost entirely, on wooden pilings that are driven into the bottom of a silty lagoon and that basically bridge all these little, barely above the waterline islands. And that's what it's built on, the entire city. So the whole thing is built on something that never reaches anything immovable, basically. And it's kind of interesting because right now the way the numbers are in terms of the sinking of Venice, it's sinking about an inch per decade, about just over 9 inches in the last 100 years. And you combine that with the fact that the sea is rising, and you have the irrevocable fact that Venice is going under. And it felt like a good thing to see it now, you know, a little bit once in a while. And when this isn't in my notes, but just St. Mark's Square, San Marco, which is kind of like the image of Venice, this huge rectangular, what Napoleon famously called the greatest drawing room in Europe. Has these stone grates in it that used to be the entry points to underwater clay cisterns that held the city's drinking water. They no longer do. They're now porous. And when the tide comes in, often the seawater bubbles right up through those grates, and the square itself sort of fills up with a layer of water. And so you have these classy restaurants all the way around the sides of the square with these waiters in tuxedos and rubber boots. And life just kind of goes on, you know, but for a couple of hours, Venice is, you can see it sinking, and then the tide goes down and the water goes back on. It's like, you know, right? So it's right there. The reality of this is right there. I mentioned this to somebody the other day, and they asked what seemed like a fairly logical question. They said, why did the Venetians build a city there to begin with? Which is a good question, you know. Given that the mainland is within easy paddling distance. It's right there. And the short answer is that they built Venice where they did because they were afraid of barbarian attack. And mm-hmm. and when the city was founded, which is about 1,500 years ago, just getting off the mainland and onto the islands seemed to do the trick. The barbarians hit the beach and went, oh, well, that's too much work. I don't know. They went home anyway. It worked, right? So when I listen to even that part of Venice's story, I think, why, as human, in terms of a human story, one of the things that's going on there is we'll go to considerable lengths to feel safe. Like we will take risks, we will innovate, we'll do things that haven't been done before, we'll build a city where no one should, in their right mind, build a city. If that's what keeps the barbarians that we fear at bay, if that's what reduces our sense of vulnerability, we'll dig in and give it a shot. And lots of times those strategies seem to work. And this one looked like the answer for Venice. I mean, it took care of the barbarian thing. Right? And not only did building a city on an island keep away the barbarians, but it situated Venice in this sheltered lagoon, this port, and that port, in a bigger kind of world economy at that point, was perfectly situated to facilitate them being the middleman for east-west trade. And so, long story short, in the Middle Ages, Venice is the hub of the trade wheel, and they just become incredibly powerful and incredibly wealthy. Now, it's hard to argue with a strategy or belief when it's working. It's hard to argue that what somebody or even a collective or a culture says they believe is not the last word when it's just rocking it. I think that's important because I think it's one way to understand the challenge of thinking in new ways generally. And I think in the Western world and in the Western spiritual world, that's instructive. We need to pay attention. There's a lesson for us here. And in particular, there's a lesson for us here about, as Christians or people exploring Christianity or considering that, in particular about some sort of prevailing North American Christian beliefs. So I'll pick an easy target to illustrate. But there are lots of ways we could explore this. So the idea, for instance, that faithful adherence to particular moral and theological frameworks will equal material wealth as a sign of God's blessing. There's an example of a framework for belief, right? You just try to talk a wealthy Christian out of that cherished equation. Yeah. And not only are you likely to get blasted, depending on personalities at play, but you're likely to come out looking like a faithless idiot. Like, you really are. Because, hey, look right here in the multi-vehicle garage next to my fabulous home, and here's the evidence that this works. And that's a very hard thing to contend with. And if you wanted to put that into Venetian terms, you go down to San Marco, you go down to this square, and you observe these large and spectacularly ornate rulers' palaces, the Doge's Palace, the only palace of a major European center that is not fortified. How successful do you have to be? How powerful do you have to be before you can build your center of government and the home for the hub of that center, in terms of person, on the waterfront, undefended? Don't try to tell me this isn't working, because look what we just did. Look what we pulled off. For centuries. It's hard to argue with success. It's an interesting thing, though. The Venetians, I mean, religion, of course, plays into all of this, and the Venetians wanted to be the hub, not just of the trade wheel, they wanted to be the hub of the religious wheel, too. And they weren't about to get deterred in this. In 828 AD, they famously, they like to say liberated, they stole the bones of St. Mark and imported them. Because they were importers, that's what they did. So they stole the bones of St. Mark. Because, see, Venice had everything except a holy relic, right? And you're just not on the religious map if you don't have a relic. I went through a whole room of finger bones in Venice, in requillaries, in little glass boxes. I mean, these things matter, you know? And so they stole St. Mark's bones and brought them back to Venice. Oh, man. I shouldn't even get started. Yeah, well, they're entombed. But their entombment is a spectacular. It's the entire end of San Marco. It's this huge church, right? The funny little corollary story is that they lost St. Mark's bones while they were building the cathedral, and then they anyway, it took them a while to find them again, but they did. Apparently, they ostensibly did. Anyway, so they wanted to be on the religious map too. So God help us, the church stole St. Mark's bones to bring them to Venice. Anyway, so. There's this whole kind of thing. But if you'd been in Venice while all this was happening, right? If you'd been in Venice when it was working, whether you'd come as a visitor to look at it from the outside or you were inside the system, there's almost no way anyone could have convinced you that this wasn't the last word in how things worked. But this is where we need to pay attention, or history is going to teach us nothing. And in the story of Venice, we have a chance to look just head on at the fact that our best human shot at problem solving is a limited one. It just is. For Venice, this middleman role in the Middle Ages was so successful. They were a very cosmopolitan, embracing culture. And when you go visit there now, even their architecture, even their religious architecture, which in most other European locations tends to have a little bit of a singularity about it, in Venice it doesn't. It's like this polyglot mashup of all the different cultures that they were doing business with and trading with. And they couldn't decide what kind of an arch to use in Venice. East, west? Like, everything just kind of met in this thing. And so it's fascinating. And the money just rolled in until the Europeans discovered North America and different trading routes to the Orient opened up. And all of a sudden, everything didn't have to flow through Venice anymore. And Venice started to go into decline. Now, that's a pretty easy to see kind of illustration of how an entire city and a culture can be built on something that when it's working was super dominant and hard to challenge, but it didn't last. But here's the curious extension to that story. When Venice started to lose its power, 17th and 18th century, it went into party mode. And it just started to spend all that accumulated wealth like mad. And when you visit Venice today, most of the high-profile, you know, kind of gobsmacking things you see, the things that really just make you go, whoa, most of that was built in 17th and 18th century with all that accumulated wealth. When Venice was in ebb, it was receding from influence and trying like mad to feel like it wasn't. That's instructive in itself. Ever meet an overly made-up elderly person. I don't know what kind of illustration to use here that's not unkind. From our culture, anyone, any age for that matter, just trying too hard to hold on to something that's no longer germane to that person or that culture or that whatever it is. And you just, when you encounter it, you kind of go, that doesn't taste good. No, that's not right. That's not lovely. But a lot of what is spectacular about Venice now happened then. This whole thing with the masks and Casanova and you know, all of that, that's that period. But, and I think this is also that part of that what can history teach us bit, when we visit Venice today, most of that decadence is in decay. Venice is shabby. I mean, that's partly why I liked it. It's not just sinking physically. Venice basically survives on the artificial respirator of tourism. Tourism is Venice's industry. That's what is there. It's home today to about 58,000 people. That is down about twice that number from only 3 decades ago, 30 years. People are leaving Venice at a rate of about 1,000 a year. It's not very hard to do the math to see how many years it'll take before Venice is a ghost town at that rate. That's not even a lifetime. And already over half the people that live in Venice are in entry-level pay jobs in the tourist industry, and they can't really afford to live in Venice, and so they're moving to the islands around Venice or to the mainland. They commute to their shabbily decadent tourist attraction for their day jobs. Let's go back to that song that we started with for a moment, because it's interesting in this regard. The song was written by John Mann and Jeffrey Kelly for the Canadian folk rock band Spirit of the West. The song is about Mann's honeymoon in Venice with his wife, Jill Baum. And Mann was infatuated with Venice. He loved Venice. And in the song, he basically expresses that. He alludes to that infatuation by suggesting that if the city sinks, he'll go down with it. And if Venice is sinking, then I'm going under. Really taken with it. And I can appreciate that. I felt like there were ways that Venice, to use Mann's lyric, christened me with wonder as well. It was really remarkable. But what really grabs me about that song is the way that the songwriters obliquely connect the decay of Venice to the decay of Christendom. It's very insightful. It's a fine piece of songwriting, whether you like it or not, as a song is entirely aside from its craft. It's really good. This is verse 1. Jesus hangs behind the glass above Venetian doors. His window box boasts crimson flowers, fresh cut the day before. And you couldn't find a smile if you nailed it to his face. But Jesus Christ hangs his head with grace. Shabby decline, decadence in retreat, power in retreat, influence in retreat, meaning in retreat. These guys are good enough songwriters not to be explicit about it, but for Mann, it comes through clear enough that whatever it is that captivated his spirit while he was in Venice, it wasn't the Jesus behind the glass. It wasn't the objects of historic Christian religion that were on display, and there's lots of them. It was beauty. It was beauty that christened him with wonder. It's beauty that he's worshiping, if he's worshiping anything. It's beauty that he would go under with and for, not religion. For Mann, religion has become an artifact. It's not something that lives and breathes. It's not something that's vibrant. It's not been challenging. It's sure as hell isn't something that's beautiful. As he says, you couldn't find a smile in that realm if you manufactured it and nailed it onto Christ's face. Does any of this sound familiar? I don't mean the song. I mean the feelings. I think, I'm speculating, of course, but I think they would have felt familiar to Jesus. And the reason I would say that is because I often get the impression from Jesus' words as we have them in a Christian sacred text that he was pretty unambiguous about his disaffection for religion that served itself. He really didn't have a lot of time for the way of thinking about religion that would motivate religious leaders to steal the bones of a saint so they could get on the religious map. And I'm not asking us to answer this, but I think it's worth pondering what the contemporary equivalent of that kind of behavior would be. And I think as a community, I think it's worth pondering. What would we do as a religious community to get on the map? If you want to put it another way or into a different context, why would we do what other prominent churches or groups are doing so we can have what they have, whatever that version of success or notoriety might be? And what would keep choices like that from being just as absurd as stealing the bones of a saint? Maybe that's why when Jesus is at this dinner party that he's at in Luke chapter 5, and somebody quizzes him about how come his disciples are eating and drinking when John's disciples are fasting and the Pharisees are fasting, he offers up this pair of parables. We're not going to get into them in any depth tonight. We will when we come back to his parables as we go along. But he offers up this pair of parables about not patching an old garment with new cloth and not putting new wine into old wineskins. New cloth, he says, will rip the old garment, and the new wine will burst the old wineskins. And it seems to me, although there are many different reads on those parables, of course, that Jesus is essentially saying that that previous way went as far as it'll go. And I've come to show you a new way, and it just won't fit within the constraints of the old one. It won't fit that frame. Richard Rohr, whom I'm just enjoying more and more as I go along, says that religion's job is to keep reminding us of what we only know in part. And he would make a strong case. He would say that's basically religion's only job. That's what it exists to do when it's doing what it ought to do, is remind us of what we only know in part. And it seems to me that if we look around us, if we look within ourselves, if we feel like what we're seeing in the world of faith and belief in particular, if we feel like what we're saying there, either within or without, is like a religious artifact, it's like Jesus behind glass, something from antiquity, then I think one of the lessons that both history and the person and teachings of Jesus are trying to teach us is that the way to God won't fit that frame. It just won't. If there's nothing that we're seeing from that vantage point that has about it the hum of life, that has the kind of beauty that we would go down with the city for, that christens us with wonder, then we just might be looking at something whose day has come and gone. And it might be time to let it teach us that it's okay to let our previous paradigm go. That it's okay to learn from the past, that it's okay to move on into new terrain, into new ways of thinking and understanding and even of believing. God is not the size and shape of any particular historic belief system, any more than success is the size and shape of any particular historic ideology or methodology. So, yeah, we had a great trip. It's good to be home. Not least of all because this community reminds me every day that belief isn't static, that it isn't an artifact, but it's something that can christen me with wonder, that it's something that can stir me the way beauty stirs me, that it can stir me the way that love stirs me, and that it can stir me to the point where I don't want to live without it. And if I have to live without it, I'll go down with the city, you know. I don't want to live that way. Even if it means leaving behind what appears to be working to move into the future, seeking, as Jesus says, a life that is more and better than I can imagine. Peace.